saving the nation's independent restaurants. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, they're the bedrock of local economies, but restaurants are in dire trouble. Now there's a national campaign to save them in this pandemic. Let us know how you feel about this. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, back-to-school shopping is tax-free this weekend. Might look a little different this year. We'll have some tips and suggestions. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, Florida has now topped 500,000 coronavirus cases. There are 7,627 deaths in the state, 281 in our area. Amidst these numbers, we want to focus right now on a bedrock of the nation's economy. But thanks to the pandemic, a new forecast projects that 1 in 3 U.S. restaurants may close permanently this year. 1 in 3. This industry is being decimated, and it's one that employs millions of Americans. Restaurants have already been forced to shed millions of jobs already this year. And given this dire situation, there is a new national movement afoot to save America's restaurants. Listen to this.
Neighborhood restaurants are the lifeblood of our communities. They are where we come together and make lifelong memories. And right now, they are facing extinction. The COVID-19 crisis threatens to permanently close 85% of independent restaurants. 16 million people risk losing their jobs, disproportionately impacting people of color and single mothers. They are our friends, our neighbors, our farmers, our bartenders, our family. 1 in 4 people who lost their jobs during the pandemic were restaurant workers. Without your help, our favorite places to eat will be gone forever. Tell Congress to pass the Restaurants Act now. Visit SaveRestaurants.com.
And of course, that was Morgan Freeman you just heard. Just imagine your neighborhood without your favorite little cafe or coffee shop or watering hole. It's a terrible picture to contemplate. We want to focus on this right now as we speak to two local restaurateurs. Allison DiRizio is the co-owner of the 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield. Hi, Allison.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. Also with us, Lori Jarvis. She's the co-owner of Cool Moose Cafe in Riverside. Hi, Lori.
Good morning.
Good to have you as well. Two fabulous independently owned local places that we want to spotlight. But if you're a restaurant owner or just somebody who likes going out to eat, we want to hear from you right now as we talk about the national campaign to save restaurants. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is already getting a lively discussion going. Allison DiRizio, let's start with you. I freely admit my bias as a Springfield resident. I love your eatery, 1748 Bakehouse on Main Street in Springfield, right there at Main and 8th. You are open for takeout and delivery. We need to stress.
Yes, we also have some indoor seating.
That's right, and some indoor seating. So how are you doing right now in this pandemic?
Well, you know, it's been an interesting pivot for us. When this first started, we closed the dining room like all restaurants did, and we brought in some of our grocery items because Springfield is a bit of a food desert, and we felt that it was important to help the farmers who were at the height of their produce season. So we had local produce and other local products. Since restaurants have opened back up, we decided to only open up at about a 50% capacity inside, including our tables and our bar area. And so we brought in more grocery bodega items, and we've done family meals. And thus far, we've been able to sustain. We have had layoffs. Business is down about 30% across the board. That is actually also a national average, so we are in good company. Mm-hmm. But we are hanging in there.
I'm so glad to hear that. Lori Jarvis, how are things at Cool Moose, a beloved local eatery in Riverside at Park and King? You know, before this pandemic hit and restrictions hit, you had to stand outside for an hour to wait to get into your place for brunch. How are you guys doing?
Well, I say that and I also am a Springfield resident, and I also love 1740 Big House and the owners. They are amazing. But with that being said, we mirror the same thing that Allison is going through. It's the same numbers. We shut down, and we did take out in curbside, and then we went to 50% capacity on the inside and really stressed outside eating just to follow the CDC guidelines. And also, while we were doing that, we did family meals, and that was also from the help of Allison and her guidance of something to do to help us sustain, and that's what Cool Moose has been doing. But unfortunately, that's not the case for most restaurants. They're not even sustaining. They're not even open. Some of them are not even breaking even at this point.
Right. It's 549-2937 to join us. So then the Independent Restaurant Coalition has been formed to save local restaurants and bars affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And the goal is to get Congress to do something to support the nation's 500,000 local independently owned restaurants and bars. They anchor our communities. They drive tourism. They employ nearly 12 million people across this country. So let's talk, Allison, about the Restaurants Act. This is a bipartisan bill that you're trying to call attention to so that people can contact their congressman or senator. Tell us about the Restaurant Act. What does it establish?
So the Restaurant Act establishes a fund that would go directly to independent restaurants, not to chains or franchises. We understand that they also have needs, but this specific act is solely for the independent restaurant who does not have savings in their coffers like some of those bigger organizations and businesses. Most restaurants report, more than 70% of the restaurants report that they have at least $50,000 in debt. And most of these outstanding bills, that debt is directly correlated and connected to their farmers, their fishermen, their bakers. And that debt that they're sitting in right now needs some help. So this fund would go directly towards helping get them in a much more financial stable place.
Okay.
One of the things that this is, people are saying is that this is just a bailout, and it actually isn't, in the respect that a bailout oftentimes has no reciprocal value. What this will do is it will put money back into communities. It will put money back into the farms and the producers immediately. I don't know if there's a staggering statistic that says 90% of all income that comes through a local restaurant stays in the community.
Right. So this is economic development. If you're just tuning in as we speak with the owner, the co-owner of 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield and Cool Moose Cafe in Riverside, Avondale, what are your questions about the Restaurants Act? How often do you or did you go out to eat at a locally owned restaurant, stop at a locally owned bar for a drink with friends? Think about your community, your neighborhood, with none of those establishments standing or very few. You know, I have nothing against chain restaurants like McDonald's or Outback Steakhouse or any place that people might be going right now. But think of a community without any independently owned eateries and bars. It wouldn't be anything like the vibrancy that we've enjoyed in this country for so long. So we want your calls. It's 549-2937. And, you know, Lori, when it comes to your restaurant, Cool Moose Cafe, Allison mentioned that most restaurants have a lot of debt, carry a lot of debt. You and the bakehouse are a little better fixed, but this is something people need to understand about this business, is that it operates on very thin margins. And most restaurants can't afford to sit out 6 or 8 or 12 months of closure and then come back. right?
Right, correct. I mean, it was even said in the commercial that 80% of independent restaurants will close down without assistance. And so Alyssa and I are for the voice that although we are sustaining, we're for those organizations like the minority-owned places, the single moms, or those that are just getting started out, or those that are in extreme debt at this point. And so with that being said, our business model is different from most. You know, I can attest that I don't do it for the money. I do it for the love. I do it for the passion of seeing food being served to our guests and them being happy. And so when I explain this business model to you, some people will say, this is crazy. Why are you even in this business? Aren't you here for the money? But most of businesses depend on substantial business, which means that it has to be continuous and that we have to max out our seats in order to make money. And we pay our bills from last week's revenue. So with that being said, if we've been closed down or if we've had regulations that don't allow us to max out our seats, then we're in a position that we're not going to be able to not only sustain, but to, you know, as Allison said, help the food chain that comes along with it, our farmers, our bakers, our drivers, our middlemen, vendors, our farmers market. So we're going to be in a position where we're going to have to depend on the government even more because of the unemployment rate that we will add on if we close down.
Right. And so I think it's important to explain that, as Allison said, this isn't a bailout. Because restaurant owners, if anything, they're a pretty hardy bunch, Allison. They have a high tolerance for risk. They have nerves of steel. Most restaurants fail, let's be clear. So The ones that are successful are run by people like you and your husband, Kurt, real pros who really know how to succeed in a tough industry. And so I think it just shows you how tough things are that you even need to be going to Congress right now, because this isn't something your industry would typically do.
No, absolutely. So like in our case, Cool Moose has been around for many years, but in our case, we are a relatively new restaurant. So we are still carrying SBA loans, startup cost, that sort of thing. And this, you know, this would ensure that other businesses who are still carrying, whether it's build out loans or payroll loans or other things that they do to survive, that they could get some relief. You know, it's interesting. The small restaurant industry is about 3.5% of the U.S. GDP. That's enormous. And this is what we're fighting for. We're fighting for, as Lori said, the small independents, the folks that we do, many of us, like she said, pay this week's bills with last week's revenue. And, you know, payroll is always a big bite for us. And the PPP loan obviously helped, but it doesn't cure things. And to be quite frank, it wasn't geared towards small businesses, even though to independent restaurants, there were a lot of loopholes. The fabulous thing about this Restaurant Act is that the loopholes have been, they've had a team of experts who are actually searching those out and closing those.
Allison, let me ask you quickly, if this act were to pass, what would be the average amount a restaurant like yours or Cool Moose would receive? Do we know that?
You know, Melissa, that I don't know. I do know that the act is asking for $120 billion to go into a fund that would go to the small restaurants, bars, and I'm sure it will be based upon our revenue and our employees.
Right.
I see. Based on revenue and employees. Okay. Yeah. And Lori says the same.
And I want to clarify it. It will be compared to the revenue of 2019. So it's pretty much like saying we're going to take a snapshot of what 2019 looked like for you. And we're going to equate the fact that the pandemic is preventing you from making that revenue in 2020. And so just like Allison said, it's not like the PPP. They are creating situations where even in the first 14 days, the grant is going to go to the marginalized and underrepresented communities, such as women, veterans, and minority-owned businesses that didn't even get a chance to have a fighting chance for the PPP.
Okay. Got it. And if you're just tuning in, as we talk about the Restaurants Act, a bipartisan bill that's in the Senate and the House, you can go to the website saverestaurants.com and let your senator or Congress representative know you expect them to support the Restaurants Act to save the nation's restaurants and bars in this pandemic. 549-2937. Give us a call. Shy is on the north side. Hi, Shy.
Hi. I just want to say I love, Ms. Lori, I love your restaurant, the Cool Moose Cafe. It actually was one of the huge deciding factors of me and my husband actually moving to Jacksonville.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Where'd you move from? We moved from Alabama.
Okay. So why did the Cool Moose attract you to Jacksonville?
Well, we just finished moving into our new house, and it was at probably 5 in the morning, and by the time we finished around 9, we wanted to get some breakfast, and we didn't want to get Waffle House because, you know, how many times have you eaten at Waffle House? We just wanted to try something new, so we Googled any local brunch places, and yours was the first to pop up. And when we went, everyone was so nice, and we sat at the bar, and, you know, it was just great service. The atmosphere was wonderful, and it just felt really nice, like a good community. And that's what we were looking for, because there's not so many local restaurants out there anymore, especially when you travel. You just see nothing but franchises.
Yeah.
And we will lose it. That's a huge part of American history. Like, restaurants are a huge part of it.
Absolutely. And so it would be terrible. Shy, it's great to hear your testimonial there. Thanks for that. And Lori, Allison, that gives you an idea of why this is so emotional important for people. Because restaurants really are about community. When you support a local restaurant in your neighborhood, you're supporting the local community.
Think about the number of after-school treats for a job well done at school, or business meetings, a quiet place to work, a celebration with girlfriends on the weekends. There's so many memories, and we are America's memory keepers. Our small independent restaurants are where so much of our lives happen.
Right, and Lori, you've got a lot of fans. Both of you have such devoted fans and loyal customers who are letting you know how important your eateries are, because they are places where you solidify friendships and make memories. Lori?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for just that testimony. It helps, you know, our hearts, because I, you know, follow Allison's page and talk to Allison. I know how much people love her and her community. And so that's why we continue to do what we are doing, because of our customers. And we are beyond blessed that we're still here after 5 months of being in this pandemic because of our guests. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to miss that. Thank you, guests, for just keeping us and keeping us going and helping us to, you know, fight the good fight.
Let's go to a few of your Facebook and Twitter comments. We've got to buy at and support local businesses, says David on Facebook. And he asks everyone to go to the Eat Local Jacksonville support during COVID page on Facebook. Jenny writes, I'm doing a lot of takeout and generous tips. Bernardo replies, I do the same, but it's not enough. We have to get back to normal to save industries, not just restaurants. I think that's how most people feel. They want to get back to normal, but that is going to not happen overnight. And, you know, here is a tweet from a listener talking about, as we referenced, how thin the margins are for most restaurants. He writes, most people know that businesses need 5 years of operating expenses in the bank to cover slowdowns. Responsible ones open with money from their savings, not borrowed money. Too many locally owned bars and restaurants open with too much debt and operate on shoestring budgets. Okay, so Allison, do you think one change that might come out of this pandemic is a reevaluation of the business model overall for independently owned businesses like restaurants and bars?
Yes, perhaps. But I think what the listener is missing, that in this industry, there's very little investment. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to find investment for a small single unit independent restaurant. And our debt to ratio has actually been very low. And until the pandemic, we were doing an excellent job of paying everything on time and actually mm-hmm. being able to put some money in the bank. And so it's unrealistic to tell a minority run or, you know, a single mother who wants to start a business that she has to have 5.5 years of operating capital. That's not going to happen in America.
Sure.
Or anywhere. I understand the sentiment, but I think that it's not a realistic sentiment for our industry. And so I do think people are reevaluating, and I think they're being nimble and they're pivoting and they're finding new ways to draw business in. Like Lori mentioned, we're both doing family meals. That's serving a need. It's serving the need of parents who are about to go back to school and have to homeschool, and they're working from home, and, you know, they maybe didn't cook a lot to begin with, and now they're, you know, really in dire straits. And, you know, so Lori and I had the same thought, which was to step in and see what we couldn't do for them. But at the same time, it's not enough. Takeout is not enough. And we would love to get back to normal. I think everybody is in agreement. Boy, wouldn't we all love to go back 6 months. But it's not going to happen.
Not for some time. Here's a comment I want to ask Lori about. My daughter is an employee in a new fast casual restaurant bar, and they are just doing delivery at this point. She goes on to say, our society has deemed this class of workers unworthy of reasonable pay or protections. Having a service-driven economy without adequate pay and benefits has created a permanent underclass that threatens the stability of our friends and neighbors. Getting a quote-unquote real job isn't an option for everyone when the real jobs exclude candidates because they don't have cars or need more flexible schedules due to childcare and education. And so this isn't a knock on either of you as restaurant owners so much as it's an observation that we have systemic problems in this country with the way we compensate people and the lack of a safety net for people who work in industries such as yours. What are your thoughts about that, Lori?
Oh, wow. I love that was brought up. I want to first address the fact that I do believe that we are considered the silent workers. And when I say silent workers, the majority of restaurants are owned by immigrants or minorities or women or veterans. And for some reason, we are constantly overlooked, and we have to always find a way in our own industry because we don't have anything to compare it to. We are such a different entity. And that even comes into how we pay our team members. And so with the front of the house, it has been such a disparity from the back of the house because our profit margins are so small. We don't want to have a French, let's say for instance, French toast. If we really were paying a team member in the back of the house $25 an hour, which he rightfully or she rightfully deserves, you would be paying $25 for French toast and bacon.
Right.
And that's something that maybe most people wouldn't even go out to go out and do. And so what we've had to do is get creative. And I can only speak upon the Cool Moose Cafe. And the pandemic has created a situation where now we pay everyone the same hourly, and then they split a tip. Does the front of the house, quite frankly, enjoy all of that? You know, I'm going to be honest with you. We are lucky to have some really amazing front of the house that has been rallying around that because they see that there's such a difference in pay rate. And so I think what you're going to see is the pandemic is going to create a situation where we're going to have to adjust and change things that have not worked and talk about some things that haven't been great in our industry for so long. And I think that's across the board. It's not just the restaurant industry. So I hear her when she says, you know, like I said, it's a silent worker, the one that gets overlooked. And can we do better in our industry? We're always striving to do better.
Yeah.
And this pandemic has put us in a position where we, you know, have to reevaluate.
And the pandemic has laid bare just how vulnerable so many workers are across so many sectors of this economy we all are in. So again, if you go to saverestaurants.com, you can tell Congress to pass the Restaurant Act. It takes just a minute or two to click. And Allison, let's reiterate your eatery, 1748 Bakehouse, Lori's restaurant, Cool Moose Cafe in Riverside, are open and open for business. People need to keep going out and supporting their neighborhood restaurants right now.
Absolutely. Yes, please. We're very grateful.
Well, thank you both so much. Allison Dorizio is the co-owner of 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield. Lori Jarvis, co-owner of Cool Moose Cafe. That's at Park and King in Riverside, Avondale. The Bakehouse is at 8th and Main in Springfield. They are doing limited seating, takeout, delivery, and just support your independently owned restaurant in whatever neighborhood you happen to be in. Ladies, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And again, it's saverestaurants.com to learn more and support the Restaurants Act of 2020. Much more still ahead. Later, we're going to see how craft distilleries, another threatened sector, are faring right now in this pandemic. But up next.
So our goal is to prepare those students for the workforce by providing them opportunities to develop personal workplace and technical skills grounded in academics.
It's timely as Skills USA sets up shop in Florida for students focused on careers outside of college. We'll be right back. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Regina King is proud to be an American, and part of that means being brave enough to demand more.
Part of me being proud is because I do recognize how ugly America can be and has been.
Actress Regina King on race and policing and her Emmy-nominated work on HBO's Watchmen. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday at noon here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Skills USA is setting up shop in Jacksonville. This organization promotes career and technical education for students, and they even get them competing at a high-stakes event. I spoke about it with Jessica Graber. She's the state director of Skills USA Florida. Jessica, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as well.
So Skills USA has come to Jacksonville. You're a Jacksonville native. Tell me how this came to be and how you brought it to the community.
So I've been the director of this organization for going on 5 years. We are a career and technical student organization serving students who are in CTE programs across the state of Florida. So our goal is to prepare those students for the workforce by providing them opportunities to develop personal workplace and technical skills grounded in academics.
And CTE stands for, just so people understand what that is?
That's career and technical
education. Career and technical education. Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're expanding into this community. What are the opportunities for students?
So our students are involved through their school. Different schools will establish a chapter with us, and then they become eligible to compete against their peers. So the event that we'll be having in Jacksonville in April will be students from across the state of Florida gathering together to compete in a variety of skill and leadership competitions. We facilitate over 100 of those competitions over 2 days. And so the students are competing for scholarships, prizes, and also for an opportunity to move on to the national level competition.
What are these competitions like?
We have everything from welding and carpentry to IT, graphic design, culinary arts, cosmetology. So the students are tested on their technical skills and abilities based on the program that they're enrolled in their school. So, for example, the welding contest, the students have to exhibit, you know, a TIG, a MIG, a GMON, SMOL, different welding techniques in a practical sense. And so it's a tactile exercise for them.
Wow, that's cool. And this is exciting to talk about, too, because, you know, not every child is necessarily planning for college. This is a way to highlight both college and career. You focus on career and technical education. That there's really been a return to that in recent years in K through 12. Why do you think that is?
I think that finally, as a society, we are realizing, like you said, that not every student is made for college and not every career requires a college degree. So we encourage students to evaluate all of their opportunities, whether it is the military, apprenticeship, internship, direct employment, college, state college, technical program, whatever that looks like for them. We want to provide them a world of opportunities so that they can really see what exists for them beyond the classroom. And we work to also to foster the soft skills that are lacking in our workforce. So communication, teamwork, responsibility, professionalism. We are encouraging our students to really develop those skills and be able to articulate those skills as well. And really just prepare the well-rounded employee no matter what industry they choose to pursue.
Now let me ask you, too, as we look at the returning students in the new academic year, how can students in a CTE program really participate in this curriculum if they're going to be doing it, for the most part, virtually, online?
Yeah, so we have some really, of course, with everyone else in the world, we've had to adapt the way we do things for our new COVID normal. And so we have created some really great virtual resources for our teachers and students to use in the classroom. We have a piece that is surrounding virtual interviewing. So we see many employers turning to virtual interviewing practices in order to hire their employees. And so we want to prepare our students. In the past, we have historically always prepared them for an in-person job interview. So we're kind of expanding on that and preparing them for the actual virtual interactions and the technology that goes behind that. So making sure that their background is clear, their sound and their video works, and their internet connection is good and all of those things. We also have a couple of recruitment opportunity events. Some of our business partners are going to be participating in a virtual Meet the Employer. So those will be webinars designed to answer the questions students have about entering and being promoted within a particular field. So for example, the American Culinary Federation is going to be hosting our first webinar in September, and they're going to bring a couple culinary recruiters and chefs to answer questions from culinary students about how to prepare for their interviews, what skills are most important, what industry certifications do they need, how do they get promoted, and then provide an opportunity for those partners to recruit amongst those students who are in culinary programs.
Very cool. It's exciting to see this come to town. It's Skills USA Florida, and she is State Director Jessica Graber, based here in Jacksonville. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the nation's craft distilleries have been pivoting and getting creative in this pandemic. They leaped into action several months ago to produce hand sanitizer when we all went into quarantine because there was a great demand for it, and distilleries were uniquely set up to produce that product. That has since tapered off, though. So where are distilleries now? Well, Mike Diaz is CFO and co-founder of the St. Augustine Distillery, and he's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Melissa. Thanks for having us on today.
It's so good to have you on. You were recently profiled in the New York Times, along with some other distilleries, about what you have been up to for the last several months. You had to stop producing bourbon, but you realized you could produce another alcohol-based product, hand sanitizer. You'd been doing that for some time, and so where are things now?
Right, and so we're excited. That article that Times came and visited us and chatted with Phil, and we spent a bunch of time with them. They and that article ran today in the terrestrial version. It was 2 days ago online, August 4th online. And so, we got very busy, had to register with the FDA, made hand sanitizer, did a bunch of that, sold a little, gave as much as we could away. But it's a very different business. It takes a lot of alcohol. You know, your typical bourbon is about 44 to 50% alcohol. Hand sanitizer has to be at least 70% alcohol to be effective. The recipe we were using, the World Health Organization recipe, was 80%. So it takes quite a bit of alcohol. And as you can imagine, while distilleries can do this and it takes, you know, special chemicals to denature it, things that we don't typically order. We're not as efficient as a Purell or somebody. So once the initial crazy demand abated a little and the companies like Purell could catch up and do what they do, it really is doesn't make a lot of business sense for distilleries to stay in this. So we're having to pivot again and really look at ways that we can continue to service the customer, service our community, and stay in business.
Yeah. And it, as I read in the New York Times, the St. Augustine Distillery is back now to producing bourbon again. But of course, sales are off in this pandemic. It is frustrating to read that you and the other distillers around the nation did your civic duty in producing all this sanitizer. But now you could use a lifeline, just like the restaurant owners we talked to earlier.
Well, for us, about 50% of our total cases, but a large percentage of our profit comes from our tours and our on-site sales. And so obviously during COVID shutdown, we are significantly down there. And our sales outside the distillery, obviously there's two big channels that consumption is driven by. One is the retailers, so the liquor stores that you would go into. And the second is the bars and restaurants and hotels. Those guys, as you just talked about, are significantly down. So one solution we've seen nationally, and we believe in this strongly, is to allow craft distillers to ship directly to consumers. And this is just so glaringly obvious and beneficial to everybody. It's tough for us to not see how we can't just enact it.
Mm-hmm.
But in many states, including California and New York, the governors have signed emergency orders that allow the craft distillers to ship directly to consumers. So you're protecting the consumer's safety. You're giving the consumers choice. The state gets the benefit of that revenue because, by the way, consumers are ordering spirits online today just from other states. And you keep these distilleries in business, which allows us to keep jobs, which allows us to contribute back to the community. So we're really hopeful that Florida will, you know, join the movement to allow craft distillers to ship directly to consumers.
So you're appealing to the Florida legislature on this. Where are they with it?
There's nothing in the legislature right now because they're not in session. But what we're appealing is directly to the Department of Professional and Business Regulation. We're appealing to the governor, and we are going through the legislative process. But in the interim, because this is COVID waits for no man, as we've seen, in the interim, the thing that we've seen other states do is issue an executive order from the governor. And that's what we would love to see happen because again, we're long-term investors in this business, right? We want to be here forever for our community. But we need help now.
So you need Governor DeSantis to do what other governors have done and just issue an executive order that would help you stay in business. And let's talk about the fact that the St. Augustine Distillery, like distilleries around the country, is you're an attraction and you're an economic driver. You conduct tours of a historic facility in addition to your sales. And so this goes beyond just the sale of liquor. You are part of economic development for St. Augustine.
Absolutely. And the attractions and tourism industry is really a virtuous cycle that when we help bring folks into that community, they're renting hotel rooms, they're eating at restaurants, they're going to bars, they're spending money in the shops, and so it really is something that does really drive the community or drive the economy in the community in multiple ways. And there's just as a business where we bring people in for tours, and we really build a relationship with that customer where they have a great experience and they learn how it's made and they've seen how it's made. We want to continue that relationship with that customer and bring them back to St. Augustine. And when they can't get back to St. Augustine, like a time like now where they may not be traveling, we want to be able to continue that relationship. And so, you know, there's multiple states that allow craft distillers to ship directly to consumers with no negative effects. We haven't had any real issues with this. And we think it would be a wonderful thing to really help, you know, preserve jobs and you know, really allow the state to participate in where the economy is going.
So how can people support the St. Augustine Distillery right now?
Well, there's multiple ways. A, we'd love to, if you feel safe and comfortable, we'd love to see you come see us. We can still sell our hand sanitizer and, we're out of the hand sanitizer now, but we can still sell our mixers, apparel, and everything online. We'd love that. Of course, ordering and going into your local retailer and buying the products is very helpful. And
your product is all around town, right? Not just at your location.
No, that's correct. So you can go into any of the major spirits retailers carry our products. That's helpful. And you know, anything you can do to contact your state representatives to really bring Florida into the forefront, where these other states have reacted responsibly and aggressively, would be very helpful.
So again, it's your way, everybody, of supporting a locally owned business that generates a lot of revenue for St. Augustine. The St. Augustine Distillery profiled this week in the New York Times, the nation's distillers had been producing hand sanitizer as their civic duty when the pandemic began. Now they are having to pivot their business model once again. And so if you live in St. Augustine, check them out. And I want to thank you so much for educating us on all of this. Mike Diaz is CFO and co-founder of the St. Augustine Distillery. Mike, keep the faith, and thanks for all of your support of WJCT, and keep in touch.
Melissa, we really appreciate it, and thank you as always for doing what you do, and thank you for having us on.
Thanks so much. A quick break, and in a moment, speaking of shopping, this weekend is tax-free weekend in Florida for all of you back-to-school shoppers. Some tips and advice right after this. We'll be right back.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpenn.com for more information.
WinGuard, a Jacksonville-based marketing and communications agency, provides Northeast Florida businesses with services to help with their reopening, such as digital and social media marketing, local advertising, and public relations. More information at wearewindguard.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. India is one of the most densely populated countries in the world, and COVID-19 cases are surging there. We'll have the latest. Plus, a musician who defies definition. He's country, trap, hip-hop, R&B, and more. We'll talk with Breland as part of our series on how artists are reflecting the current moment in their work. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Local election officials in Texas are having trouble finding enough suitable polling places, and that worries voting rights experts.
If we have even less polling locations, it's just a perfect storm for problems that is absolutely going to lead to longer lines if we do not substantively prepare now.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How Texas is preparing for in-person voting this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on WJCT News 89.9.
COVID-19 has been described as a referendum on the ideas that brought America to a difficult but defining moment. Writers Ibram X. Kendi and Ed Young have been taking a long look at the two emergencies facing the country, racial injustice and a paralyzing pandemic. How did it come to this? We'll speak to both of them next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend, back-to-school purchases in Florida are tax-free. That includes tech, like laptops and other computer items. Now, despite the pandemic, the National Retail Federation is expecting a banner shopping weekend this season for back-to-school. So how should you attack that shopping list with your kids? I spoke about it with Mary Svoboda, Interim President and CEO of Jack's Federal Credit Union. Mary, good to talk to you.
Thank you. So nice to be with you again.
So it's a big weekend for parents, back to school shopping season, and it's tax-free weekend this weekend in Florida. Even in spite of the pandemic, they're expecting a big shopping weekend. What should we keep in mind as parents when we go shopping for back to school as we try to save a little money?
Well, like anything in life, planning is important. So I would start with an inventory. Really pull out everything. See what you already have in school supplies. I remember when my children were young, we'd end up with 7 rulers at home.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you already have a lot of these supplies on hand. And you can involve the children in that, sorting out the supplies, seeing how many markers and pens and pencils and rulers and things you already have. Also do an inventory of clothes, particularly if you have more than one child, of course. Sometimes things can be passed down. But inventory what clothes and shoes they need. And then do the same with computer equipment. Sometimes you might have extra keyboards or a mouse or whatever around the house, and you might not need to buy every single peripheral device because you can supplement with things you already have. So an inventory is where I would start first.
Great advice. And because so many kids will be learning virtually or doing a hybrid schedule, it's expected that a lot of these shopping lists will involve computers, computer accessories, printers, flash drives. What advice do you have for parents doing that kind of shopping?
Well, it is important to note that our tax-free holiday does include computers and some computer accessories up to $1,000. So that's wonderful. And then you want to make sure you're shopping for deals. You know, go online, look and see if you can find things that are on sale. You can also consider open box items for computers. Sometimes you can save a lot of money if you're willing to take that little bit of risk if it's been previously the box has been opened. Another thing to think about is that the purchases that you make can be staggered. You might not need all of your supplies, you know, this weekend. So, for example, coats and long pants and things like that could be purchased later in the year. So that's one way of kind of breaking up the list and making it not as burdensome. The National Federation for Retail said that the average person will spend $789 on a grade school student.
Oh, my gosh.
And over $1,000 on a college student. So breaking up those expenditures over the course of the semester might be a tool that would be helpful for some folks.
That is smart. Now, kids even still want to do back-to-school shopping. My daughters do, even if they're not going to be in class 5 days a week. So as we do buy them a few new things for the year, let's point out clothing, footwear, and accessories that are $60 or less per item are tax-free this weekend. What else should we be mindful of with these purchases?
The most important financial skill that you can teach children is that you have a budget. So if you give them a clothing budget and you tell them this is the most that you can spend, they can choose to go out and buy all designer clothes and maybe they only get three things. Or you can help them learn how they could choose one or two pieces that are meaningful maybe for them and then supplement with things from Walmart or from a thrift store and really make their clothing budget go further.
Great advice. It's it's such a cherished tradition at this time of year. It's unfortunate it's happening in the context of a pandemic, but we've got to do what we can to be positive for the kids. And certainly with so many people out there struggling economically, anything tax-free is a good thing right now, Mary.
Absolutely. And I would want to point out that there is charitable assistance for families that, are really strapped right now and would be having some difficulty. There's groups out at the beach. Beams often has back-to-school supplies, Stuff the Bus. And then one of the charities that we've donated to is the Boys and Girls Club of Northeast Florida, and they're doing a back-to-school drive as well. So there are resources out there if parents are really finding that they just don't have the cash on hand that they need for back to school.
That's right. And thank you for this. She's Mary Svoboda, Interim President and CEO of the Jacks Federal Credit Union. And happy shopping, everybody. Thanks, Mary. Again, tax-free weekend kicks off Friday, runs through Sunday. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Producer Heather Schatz will be doing some back-to-school shopping this weekend, as will I. Josh Torres, our show director, might be picking up a few tax-free items, along with station news director Jessica Palumbo and our digital editor Bill Borsfield. Keep those emails coming, meantime, to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. Or our podcast will be up later today, wherever you get your podcasts, including our website. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back here and connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Keep your smile on. We know it's there under your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.